apologies, no news today there at 5 o'clock, but it's Friday drive time. I'm Tony Gosling, and my guest to review this week's news in Bristol, Britain and around the world is the chair of Bristol's Public Safety and Protection Committee and Labour councillor for Lawrence Hill, Brenda Huggill. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the chief executive of Sedgemoor District Council, down towards Bridgewater, says it's simply not good enough, and the council leader described it as totally unacceptable. They're talking about plans by French energy utility EDF to build a new nuclear power station at Hinkley Point. As campaigners are demonstrating outside the gates, and scientist Chris Busby produces a report claiming to show a sharply increased risk of cancer downwind of the existing plants, Crispin Aubrey from the Stop Hinkley campaign will give us the lowdown. And electronic voting, how easy it is to hack into. We look at recent documentary on the topic entitled Hacking Democracy. That's in the second hour. On to our review of the week's news in a minute, but first here's our two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. This weekend, highs around 16 degrees Celsius, sunny on Saturday, it's tomorrow, and sunny spells on Sunday with gusty winds. Next week, highs are up again to 21 degrees Celsius, a fairly dry week with plenty of sun, cloudier and wetter towards the end of the week. Next weekend, that's the 25th and 26th of September, highs of 16 Celsius, fairly cloudy with some sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Anyway, it's time to introduce this week's guest now. With me is Chair of Bristol's Public Safety and Protection Committee and Labour Councillor for Lawrence Hill, Brenda Huggill. Welcome to Drive Time, Brenda.
Thank you. May I correct my surname? It's Huggill, or should I say second name now?
Huggill, okay. Yes. Now, what is your background? What were you doing before you became a councillor?
I took early retirement from teaching, and I taught in Penn Park, Southmead for 15 years. And Clevedon for 3 years, the last 3 years of my professional career, if you like, in that respect.
So what age children were you teaching?
Secondary.
Okay, and what were you teaching them?
In my youth, PE and geography, and then in my later years, geography.
Okay, and what about your portfolio now on the council? Public safety and protection sounds quite important, but what does it actually involve?
We look after the people, and we look after taxi drivers, and if any complaints come before us, we have to make decisions as a committee of how to deal with some of the problems that arise.
Well, it's not just taxi drivers, though, is it? What other things is your committee looking at, and how does it operate?
Street trading. So if anyone wants to put up a wagon, if you like, to serve coffee or burgers or whatever, they have to come before us for a licence.
All right. Now, the Cabinet apparently now can just override decisions of the full council if it wants to. How does that actually play out in practice, do you think? And is it working?
I'm not certain, but I am worried about certain issues like Mill Pond School in my ward, because currently the Cabinet have decided to spend £2 million of money that's supposedly unspecified to buy the land of St Ursula's. Now, I'm very worried about the impact that will have on Mill Pond School in my ward and Whitehall just up the road, because £3 million is supposed to be spent on refurbishing that building, and that hasn't started yet, and I want to know why.
OK, well, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is with us too. Martin, we hear today, and actually yesterday evening as well, actually, that MI5 are telling us we must prepare ourselves for possible terror attacks from the Somalis and the Yemenis. What are your thoughts about this announcement? Can we really trust MI5?
That's a good question. I don't think anybody in Belfast does. It's interesting that the former head of MI6 has just produced a report, Inkster, has just produced a report for the Institute for Strategic Studies saying that threats of terrorism emanating from Afghanistan and Iraq are completely exaggerated, and that in actual fact there's more danger of terrorism as a result of our intervention in those countries than otherwise.
But this isn't Afghanistan and Iraq, is it?
I'm just pointing out that the former head of MI6 is coming out with a rather different tale from the current head of MI5.
Okay. And so do you think that we should be on our guard against possible Somali and Yemeni terrorists?
I think we should be on our guard against terrorists, whoever they may be. And as we've discussed many times on this programme, they could be located within our own state structure.
Because if we remember back to last Christmas, there was the so-called underpant bomber.
Yep. Indeed, although we have eyewitnesses who were on the plane saying that he was taken directly onto the plane without going through security, and that's checkable. Laurie Haskell, top US lawyer who was on the plane, people can check his blog, Haskell, H-A-S-K-A-L-L. There's a real question mark over what goes on in this sphere. I would say that we need police primacy in investigation of everything, because the police are, at least in theory, accountable. Security services are not.
Well, they are through the Intelligence and Security Committee, aren't
they? Yes, but the problem with that is that it's not proper accountability. We've got evidence, for example, the bombings of Dublin and Monaghan in 1974, or the bombing of Boulogne Railway Station in 1980, where it's beyond doubt that those were carried out by elements within our own security forces. Nobody's ever been punished for either of those atrocities, or any of the other atrocities that which we're mentioning. I think there's always got to be doubt about whether security services are under control. That's why we need police primacy, and that's exactly what the Republican movement have been pushing for in Ireland over the last decade or so. We want police primacy, and we want the security services and the army out of here.
Well, as I said before, Labour councillor for Lawrence Hill, Brenda Hughill, I hope that's probably pronounced now, Brenda,
yes, thank you.
Is with us too. And you brought along some of the issues, haven't you, from your ward? You mentioned the school just now. What are the other things? What other things are people talking about around Lawrence Hill?
There's a problem at the moment in Ducie Road. There's a car park there, and the settlement, Barton Hill Settlement, run by amazing people, Joanna Holmes and Paul Simpson, I think his name is, and they want to use that car park, and those negotiations I thought were underway, and I was quite shocked today to find out that land has been put on disposable land with the possibility of selling it for building works. Now, that settlement does the most amazing work. They offer all sorts of courses to an immense variety of people, and they want to expand, which means more people coming into the area. They also are thinking that the National Health Service will move into the area to provide their services. So they too will need car parking space. So what is happening? Is this another thing the Cabinet are doing without letting ward councillors know what's going on?
Well, the problem is, of course, that they're under orders, aren't they? They've got to raise money from wherever possible at the moment. They've got to sell bits of land off like this. That's what they would argue anyway.
Well, are they going to do that to the detriment of an amazing organisation that serves the local people in the most fantastic way? Because if they are going to cause problems there, then those services will decline. And already there's a fear in the sense of the recession, if you like, and I'm going off the track here a bit, because people are experiencing the recession and already staying at home, isolation, not going to the events there where they may have to pay 50 pence or 150. That is too much for them. Now, what's going on, please? We need to keep this ward to the forefront. We've got a lot of people here. The population in this ward in the last 3 years has gone up from 10,350 to 15,400. That we can count. Have the services gone up? I had to fight on children and young people's services years ago for children's places for four-year-olds. I was the first one to bring that up on children's scrutiny. And our officers looked, we're expanding Cabot, we're going up in the air. I said, what is happening now? You knew those babies had been born 4 years ago. And at last, some sense is coming out. But that's only one issue. And still we haven't. You know, we're struggling with places for young children.
Well, having a look at some of the national stories now, and the first story we're looking at today is the potential, anyway, I mean, this is what Vince Cable's announcing, privatisation of the Royal Mail. Now, we've been talking about this for many years over, and it hasn't happened quite yet. There was quite an interesting article in The Guardian, that was on Wednesday this week, by someone who called himself Roy Mail. I'm not quite sure if that really is his name, but anyway, he says, we also know that the main drain on the Royal Mail's profit base is subsidising the private mail companies by carrying their mail for them. And he explains by saying they've extracted all the profitable trade from the banks and utilities, and once it comes to actually sticking it through letterboxes, that's our job. It still lands on our frames for sorting and carrying. What chance do we have? We do the work, they take the profit. Now, Martin, do you want to start on this one? I mean, what is going to happen if the Royal Mail is privatised, as Vince Cable is now saying he wants it?
Well, I think the point being made by the anonymous Royal Mail worker there is absolutely to the point, which is that the service has been cherry-picked for years by the profitable bits being given to the private sector and the unprofitable bits being left in the public sector. When the Royal Mail was an integrated service, they could cross-subsidise from one to the other to provide an integrated, a standard service all over the country. And, this push to privatisation is the final nail in the coffin of the Royal Mail as a kind of central part of British national life. And once you've destroyed something like that, if you remember a few years ago, they changed the name to Consignia and they had to change it back to Royal Mail because Royal Mail had got such a kudos.
But just a minute, you're saying they're destroying it. They're not, they're privatising it.
No, this is effective. The Royal Mail was a publicly owned, publicly managed, not-for-profit public organisation, and it was very much at the heart of British national life, including rural post offices and all the rest of it, a lifeline for the elderly, for example. By chipping it, it's been destroyed by 1,000 cuts over the years. The creation of competition, which sounds so logical, actually undermines the basis of having a national service. And of course, the privatisation is the logical result of that, but it kills off a Royal Mail as a national service. And TNT, who were talked about as being the partners for one of the people who might buy Royal Mail when Mandelson was talking about it a couple of years ago.
TNT are already running these services which collect vast amounts of mail from people like the banks and then just take them down the road to the
TNT are just sacking a large proportion of their workforce in Holland. You see, the problem with the privatisation as brought forward by the coalition government is that the whole thing was originally brought up by the new Labour government, even though the Communications Workers Union is one of the funders of the Labour Party. And of course, if you're prepared to go around kicking your own people in the teeth like that, as we were for many years, then it gives the other side a carte blanche, basically.
So what are your thoughts, Brenda, on this, on the privatisation of the Royal Mail, as we're now hearing about, announced by Vince Cable?
Well, it looks to me as though Vince Cable's a wolf in sheep's clothing. He came across before the election as everyone's darling as an MP. And now what on earth is he doing? He's following the Tory ideology of privatising things, and they want to privatise everything in sight. And, reject all sorts of local services in society that look after people that have been since Victorian days running, like the libraries. I'm just very fearful of what this man is up to.
Well, one of the conclusions of this anonymous article in The Guardian on Wednesday from Roy Mayall is that he's saying that the mood in the offices at the moment is suicidal, which is quite frightening, isn't it? And don't you think something needs to be done? Well, maybe privatisation is the answer.
Well, if the mood is suicidal, why has that been brought about? Because this country is on the verge of a nervous breakdown, because all that we hear about from Cameron and Osborne and who's the other one, the three of them, who want to do these cuts. And people are trying to forget in the sense and think it's not going to affect me. It's going to affect everyone. So if you've got this suicidal element there, they can see themselves losing their jobs. And then people talk about benefits. What do they mean by that? They will have to be supported. And yet they're going to cut the benefits. People don't even understand what benefits means, because some old age pensioners, some of us, when we get to 60 or 65, are on a state pension. Hang on, that's the right, that's the benefit. It's not just the scroungers we're talking about who want the money. These scroungers are small in number compared with all these tax evasion people. If only they paid their taxes in this country, we wouldn't be in the mess we're in now.
Martin, don't you think that there's something inevitable about this kind of thing happening during a recession?
No, because I think the problem is that what happens is that the people in power who've engineered the recession effectively and say, oh, we've got a recession now, so we've got even more excuse to do
David Cameron did not engineer the recession.
Oh, no, the banks created the problem. The banks created the problem, and David Cameron's father was a hedge fund manager. Okay, so and all of their chums, the people who funded the Tory Party election campaign, were the hedge funds and the banks. Let's not kid ourselves. So when they say that what's happening now is they're using the crisis that they have created as an excuse to push through even more the things that they wanted to do in the first place. Now, in actual fact, the only way out of a recession, as Keynes put forward, as the liberal activist Keynes said in the 30s, one of the greatest economists that ever lived, you don't get out of a recession by cutting public expenditure. And this is something that they've seemed to have forgotten. And that includes Nick Clegg. I interviewed him for this programme the other week, and he didn't seem to understand that the tradition of the Liberal Party is not to cut in a recession. And in fact, that's wrong. You shouldn't do it. It will make things worse. It will make the recession worse. And then, of course, you find yourself in worse problems than you were when you started.
And Mervyn King actually said this week, we let it slip. I believe he's the banker of the Bank of England. Just the head. The financial sector and the policymakers, they got us into this mess, and yet Cameron and Osborne are trying to blame Labour.
Well, do you think, Martin, maybe that this is a little... I mean, maybe call me cynical if you want, that the government have actually got Vince Cable as a Liberal to announce this privatisation of Royal Mail as a sort of cynical attempt to keep the Tory party clean.
What Roy Hattersley made a very good point on the radio, I think it was yesterday, and he said the problem for the Liberals with the Conservatives, it's like trying to join a New York street gang. If you want to be accepted, you first of all got to kill your best friend. And the Liberals are being sent out to give the bad news because that suits the gangsters at the head of the Conservative Party, that they should take the rap.
Now, we're going on now to look at the Ofsted report, if I can say it, which came out on Tuesday, I think, this week, which was in Wednesday's Guardian. And this is an Ofsted report into special needs. Now, apparently, we have 458,000 of the 1.65 million children who are in special needs don't need to be there at all, according to Ofsted. And in fact, many of these schools have been identifying children having special needs when they don't have them at all. As an ex-teacher, what do you think about this Ofsted report?
Oh, if only. I mean, I know from personal experience with my grandchildren that they have special needs, very bright Asperger's. And my daughter has had to fight tooth and nail to get the right education and spend money. And what frightens me is that people who can't afford to get special needs for their children, they fall through the net. And they don't.
How do you mean can't afford to? Surely this is automatic. If your children have special needs, they have special needs. You can't sort of...
The resources to
look after them. I beg your pardon. Thank you, Tony, for picking me up on that. I get so heated on some topics, I miss out little links in the middle. So okay. I'm glad you're here.
All right.
Baroness Warnock said inclusive education, we all jumped up and said with delight, fantastic. Now, I was teaching at the time, and I said, if you're going to resource this correctly, what a good idea if the parents want it. And they started closing special schools. Now, they didn't resource it properly, and I can give you an actual example of a lovely little chap, an 11-year-old, in my geography class. And he had a helper who came in, I think once or twice a week. It's a long time ago now. And he had one-to-one, but it was a class of 28. And by the second year, that's aged 12, the kids were getting fed up with him because it was hindering their progress because he took up so much time when he didn't have the helper and even when he did have the helper. Now, you're not telling me that was a good system. I had to keep quiet at the time because I had to beaver away and do my exam work, all the classes and whatever. And now, having learnt recently of the statements, it fights to get a statement, and then I'm told, you don't statement them anymore, the authority can't afford it. There are so many clashes going around. The other thing to point out to everyone now, since I began teaching many years ago, things we know so much more about children. We see them more as individuals than a group in a class, and each of them have their own needs, if you like, and some of them more so than others. Now, where is special and not special? But certainly when you've got someone with behavioural problems, when you've got disabled youngsters, they do need extra help, and they deserve it. These are our future. And you're not telling me these youngsters can't help in the future in societies, because they can.
Now, you're fighting the teacher's corner there, but Ofsted are saying, actually, these children need better teaching.
Well, that's a good defence, isn't it? I mean, wasn't it a year ago when the government was saying how well teachers have improved? And now they've come up with the crackpot idea that you can only train a teacher if they can't train them, if they've only got a third-class degree. Hang on, only got a third-class degree. Now, tell me, is it the top 12% or the top 4% that get degrees? So these people have minds, and you don't necessarily need a good degree to be a very good teacher. In fact, some people with brilliant degrees are hopeless in imparting knowledge.
Can I just say that both my parents were full-time teachers all their working lives. My father was a head teacher in a comprehensive school. Ofsted's name is mud. amongst those in the teaching profession. Ofsted should have been abolished years ago. Absolutely. Chris Woodhead, who used to head it up, is an A1 fool who has got the contempt in the classrooms and staff rooms around the country for this organisation is enormous. One of the things that the coalition could do if it really wanted to ring the changes is abolish Ofsted altogether.
But isn't this sour grapes, Martin? Because none of the teachers like being told how to do their job, do they? And Ofsted's job is to tell them.
Nor do radio journalists or anybody else. And that's one of the problems, isn't it? That people like Cameron, who've been to private schools and never taught anybody in their lives, think they know everything about teaching, whereas those who work in inner city schools know nothing. I think the answer is that the people who actually do the job tend to know, like postmen, an awful lot more about it than people who pontificate about it who have never done the job.
What's your assessment of Ofsted, Brenda, as an ex-teacher yourself?
Well, they just bring teachers into such stressful situations who dread to go into school. And is that good for a teacher when they're under such stress? They don't teach well when that's like that. What Ofsted should be looking at, if we're going to keep some form of looking at teachers and their progress and professional development, they should first of all learn to be good communicators and encourage teachers. It's typically, if you teach, you bring out the best in people. Start with a no.
Right. Encouragement.
Encouragement. What on earth's wrong with these people? Do they want to bully people all the time?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, that they're really saying that actually the fault is in that many of these special needs children actually just need better teaching. That's not really coming up with much of an answer, is it?
Oh, come on, look, you're quite right. Always they want to slag teachers off and blame them for society's ills, and that's not right. So teaching reflects society.
Okay, our next story. US-led soldiers in Afghanistan are reportedly engaged in smuggling heroin and other drugs out of the country, a British newspaper says. This is from the Iranian English language service Press TV. According to a report published in the British newspaper, the Sunday Times, British soldiers at Camp Bastion in Helmand province and Canadian soldiers based at Kandahar Airport may have been involved in trafficking drugs. Martin, do you think this is just a sort of scare story by the Sunday Times and Iranian TV?
Well, this is the kind of tip of the iceberg type of story, actually, because if you think back to the 1980s, when the Conservative government in Britain was supporting the Mujahideen resistance, as they like to call them, inside Afghanistan, they were perfectly happy for those people to be smuggling heroin. Perfectly happy. The CIA has got a documented track record of involvement in hard drugs supply. The Iran-Contra affair in the 1980s, we mentioned it last week, was all about bringing tons of cocaine into the United States to fund the Contra rebels in Nicaragua. Two CIA rendition planes crashed in Mexico earlier this year in January, full of cocaine, and these are CIA planes that have been used for rendition.
Yeah, but this is surely, what you're talking about here is organised crime. It's not our soldiers.
Well, our soldiers may be caught up in what's going on, but the point is that Walid Karzai and Hamid Karzai are the biggest drug dealers in Afghanistan, and they are our allies, as was General Noriega, as was the Colombian government, as was the Mujahideen in the 1980s. We were talking about the security services earlier, and MI5 and MI6. We've got documented evidence of their role in the drugs trade. And of course, ultimately, some people would say it was a price worth paying having young people in Bristol addicted to heroin. At least we drove the Russians out of Afghanistan. But this is a hidden history that people need to confront. Our own security services have got a documented track record of hard drugs dealing.
Brenda, what are your thoughts about this story? Do you think British soldiers and Canadian soldiers really could be dealing drugs or smuggling drugs?
I know very little about it, but it seems to me what we hear about these soldiers, they're too busy trying to keep security in there to go off on the sideline and do that. And I haven't read the story, so it's hard for me to comment.
Okay, an anonymous Afghan drug dealer told Press TV that military personnel are the second largest buyers after foreign drug lords, and said that is the military personnel, tend to place orders before they return home to the US or the UK. And the article also reminds us that back in 2001, before the invasion, the opium production from which heroin is derived was at an all-time low. But following the US invasion of the country, the poppy fields returned and production outstripped previous levels. Now, Martin, I mean, surely one of the things we should be doing over in Afghanistan is stopping this trade and halting it.
There's got to be some realism about all of this. people need to understand the history of this. I'll mention the word, the name Colonel Oliver North to people. Colonel Oliver North was at the heart of the Iran-Contra affair. This is all documented by Senator Kerry's committee. It was all investigated. And what they uncovered was that the CIA, working with Colonel Oliver North, were bringing in millions of dollars worth of cocaine into the United States and using the funds that they're therefore generated to pay for a terrorist war in Nicaragua that killed 30,000 civilians. This is all documented. It's all on the record. They were all pardoned. George Bush Sr. pardoned all these people, and not only are they not in prison, many of them are back in power. Still in power. Robert Gates, who was the current US Defense Secretary, was head of the CIA in the 1980s, when we know for a fact that we're bringing cocaine in from Colombia and heroin in from Afghanistan to fund their allies. That's not disputable, that's fact. But the same fella is still there under Obama. He was there under Bush, and he's still there under Obama. We've got to start getting realistic about the drugs trade. The drugs trade also helped to bail out the banks 2 years ago. The UN's Office on Drugs and Crime, it's quite clear that massive amounts of drug money helped to prop up the banks 2 years ago. Now, if we're serious about stopping the drug trade, we've got to close down the private banking system. But we're not prepared to do that. We're actually subsidising the private banking system.
Well, Gordon Brown propped it up, didn't he? When
indeed.
It was about to,
and so did the drug cartels.
Anyway, Brenda, can I just ask you what your thoughts are on the whole mission that we're on in Afghanistan as a whole? Do you think we should be there?
No.
Why not?
I think it's a very difficult situation. We seem to be propping up a corrupt government that got there by rigging the elections. But the question then is, how can you democratise a country where bribery and that type of culture is rife? And I really don't know the answer to that. But I do know, if you look at history, anyone who's gone into that country to try and do anything has not had any success. It's a very serious problem. We've got the training camps are the serious ones, and how could we deal with those and the radicalism? Because we have to deal with radicalism wherever it is, in whatever form. And I really don't know any answers, but I do know too many of our young men are dying for what seems to be a cause that might be dealt with in different ways.
But it's your party that actually sanctioned the invasion in the first place, and certainly has, in fact, increased troop numbers over there.
My party should have dealt with Afghanistan instead of going into Iraq, and then perhaps we wouldn't have the problem we have today.
Okay, the next story, strikes looming at the BBC. Unions at the BBC are preparing for two 48-hour strikes in the next month, which looks set to black out much broadcast news across Britain. First of the strikes is due to be on the 5th and 6th of October, which would disrupt coverage of the final 2 days of the Conservative Party conference. The second will be on the 19th and 20th of October, it seems, to coincide with George Osborne's announcement that the Treasury's public spending review. Well, I spoke yesterday to the General Secretary of the National Union of Journalists, Jeremy Deer, and asked him why staff had decided overwhelmingly to strike over the BBC's proposed changes to their staff pension scheme.
In essence, that the value of the pensions they've already earned is to be undermined by the BBC's proposals, meaning some people will lose thousands, if not tens of thousands of pounds over the course of their retirement. They believe that the scheme can be funded properly, that it should remain in place, and that the BBC should withdraw their proposals.
But the overall analysis is that the economy can't stand these big payouts by employers towards the pension schemes.
Well, that's not the reality. This is a funded pension scheme, so it is the employees and the employer jointly funding the scheme. It was significantly in surplus. The BBC took a 13-year pensions holiday. It's now miraculously in deficit, roughly by the amount that they took a pensions holiday for. They can afford it. They just have to choose what they're going to spend their money on.
Why did they take a pensions holiday then? What's that all about?
Well, they took a pensions holiday because they said it was overfunded at the time, and therefore they didn't need to put any more money into it. So instead of paying 8%, they paid 4%, which saved them about £1.2 billion.
Martin, as pension schemes around the country are having problems and difficulties, and some, of course, are folding as well, why should the BBC be any different?
It shouldn't be any different. Everybody's pensions should be protected. I mean, these are contracts that people have signed in good faith. When you join an organisation, you're assessing, well, I'd rather work for the BBC because I won't earn as much as I'm going to earn at Sky, but my pension's secure. Or I'd like to go into into nursing rather than hedge fund management, because I know as a nurse my pension will be secure. Now, people make those choices early in their careers on an understanding that they're signing a contract with the organisations that they're joining, and those contracts are just as sacrosanct as, if you remember, the bankers, when their banks went bust, were saying, but my contract says I'm entitled to a bonus of blah. And they, by and large, they got away with that. By and large, they did, even though, in actual fact, the organisations that they were claiming the money from were bankrupt. Now, these organisations are not bankrupt. What's going on here is we are all being told that we can't afford our pensions because the private sector banks have crashed the economy and run off with all of our money. Now, this has got to stop. The buck must stop where it's supposed to stop. The wealthy classes, the people who gambled on the stock market, they're the ones responsible, and they must pay. Them and nobody else. Not BBC employees, not special needs children in schools, not postmen, not teachers, them and only them. And the Labour movement as a whole has got to find its voice and make it clear that we insist that they must pay and not us. It's not a question of compromise. We're not going to find a middle way here. They must pay, we're not paying.
Brenda, don't you think that the BBC, just like anybody else, has to accept that we're in difficult economic times, and they're going to have to simply sign up to these changes that Mark Thompson and the BBC management want to make to their pensions?
Well, as a teacher, I too paid my pension and the employer paid it, and I hope it's safe, and anyone who's gone through that process, wherever they're employed, should not suddenly have their pension whipped from under them. That's, to me, is... Oh, is it illegal? I don't know. I think
the PCS took the people to court.
The PCS is the which union, Martin?
The Public and Commercial Services Union. Yeah. They of course had a dispute with the previous Labour government about this, and they took the government to court, and the government lost. These are contracts in law. You can't just rip them up. The BBC could be defeated by the courts over this.
But what's happened, of course, is that the BBC, as Jeremy was saying there, have taken what they call a pensions holiday. Is they looked at the financial situation and thought, well, we don't need to pay quite so much in this year for a couple of years. And then they realised, actually, they were in quite a big deficit. What are your thoughts about these pension holidays?
If the managers have done that, they made a decision, presumably, that they could cover the deficit in the final analysis. That means that they've got to find the money now. However they need to find it, they've got to find it.
Right, well, we'll see what happens. And those dates again are the 19th and 20th of October, potential strikes. And, of course, negotiations are going on right now, so these strikes may not happen if the BBC agrees to the union's demands. And also on the 5th and 6th of October. OK, so our next story, town green status. And this is quite a biggie. I mean, this one doesn't seem to go away, does it? It's probably about 4 years this has been bubbling on, the story of Bristol City's football ground, that town green status could halt Bristol City's stadium plans. This is in the Evening Post. And also, the particular story was from the BBC, but the Evening Post said, Bristol South's Labour MP Dawn Primorolo has pledged to continue backing the club in its ambitions for a new stadium. But local people don't agree with Dawn because they're saying that they're putting in an application which could prevent Bristol City's proposed 92 million stadium for being built. This is 200 residents are trying to have part of the site at Ashton Vale declared a town green. The status would prevent new development on the 42-acre site and put an end to the possibility of Bristol hosting the World Cup Games in 2018. Right, Brenda, where do you stand on this? Do you think that they should be able, Bristol City Football Club, to build on this site at Ashton Vale?
I think there are wider issues to look at here. First of all, there's a most wonderful picture on the front page of the Evening Post today of scrubland. And as a former geographer, or as a geographer still, I thought, oh, would I like this village green and like to have a picnic on it? And I leave that question hanging in the air. We have to go back to what Bristol wants as a city. And all too often, any big project that comes along fails. We haven't got a decent... they have improved the Colston Hall. At last, that has moved forward. But we still haven't got lots of large areas of entertainment, if you like, that other cities have.
But aren't the football club really trying to do this on the cheap by building it on fields? Why don't... You know, surely in any normal situation, they would buy up some industrial land or something like that to build it on in the city.
Is there any industrial land big enough for this?
Well, quite possibly, yes. I mean, old factories, I can't say anywhere particularly. I mean, for example, there was an area very close to Ashton Gate, which was a sort of railway yard just near there, which was enormous. which has now been redeveloped for housing. But I mean, you would have thought that there would be another site fairly close
by. Well, they've missed out then if that one's being built, it has houses. And anyhow, if you're going to talk about housing, look what's happening now. At last, and last night on Question Time, the Labour contenders for the leadership recognised they'd failed the people of this country by not building enough houses. They wake up to the fact, and now what's happening? The government's saying you can't build any. Only 12 in Bristol instead of 100,000 are going to be built. Hang on. Population's going up. Where's the sense of this? And then if you put people, if you build houses, you've got people employed. I think I've gone off the stadium, but there you go.
No, but I think it's linked because it's about infrastructural investment rather than cuts. And I think the Labour leadership election, it's funny you should mention that, because I think the contest itself has forced them to actually admit that a lot of what they were doing when they were in power was wrong. And I would be the first one to say that.
But
as
don't
a member
politicians,
of the party since 1975.
Martin, don't politicians always do that? When they're in opposition, then they've all got full of all sorts of wonderful ideas
to
get themselves
re-elected. That's how the system's supposed to work, isn't it? So they get punished by the electorate, they go away and have a think, and then they come back with it with their ideas bucked up. What's happened over the years is that we've allowed a consensus about privatisation, about we haven't built any council houses in Britain for a generation, and then we wonder why people are sleeping in the streets. You know who built the most council houses in Britain? It wasn't actually a Labour government, it was the Conservative government of Harold Macmillan in the 1950s. And there used to be a consensus about all of these things. The whole idea of letting property bubbles just run away with themselves because we haven't got enough supply of low-cost housing, that's the root of our problem. The lack of low-cost housing in this country is the root of our economic and social problems. And finally, the Labour leadership are waking up to the fact that they have been failed the country by not tackling that issue more strongly.
Well, what's your view on this Ashton Gate Stadium anyway, Martin? Do you think it should go there?
To be honest with you, we've discussed this in previous weeks and previous months with various people who've been involved with it, Conservative, Labour and Liberal. I don't know enough about it to have a strong opinion. I just want to make sure that for me, something like this should be done by the book. So if people want to object, they should be listened to. Everybody should look at the pros and the cons. I haven't got a strong view on it either way, but what I think is very important is that people, whatever decision you come to about something like this, that people can see that it's all been done transparently and fairly. For example, the football club should not be subsidised by others. You know, it should pay its own way, for example.
Okay, now the next story. A key Pope aide has pulled out of a British visit, out of the Pope's British visit, after calling the UK a third world nation. Actually, I think he was kind of comparing it to a third world nation when he arrived at Heathrow a couple of years ago. And apparently, I was chatting to some people about this yesterday, the conditions at Heathrow Airport have improved somewhat since a couple of years ago was one of the... it was leaking roofs and buckets catching the water there and things like that. But anyway, what are your thoughts, Brenda, first about the statement comparing Britain to a third world nation now?
Oh, gosh, one could wax lyrically all evening about that. But I think he's probably regretting his words at the moment because it's not terribly sensible when you've got the head of the Vatican and the head of the Catholic Church about to land in this country and call us a third world nation.
It's a bit of a public relations faux pas, really.
Okay, so are we or not?
Are we a third world nation? We've slipped about fourth or fifth in the world in the economic wealth of the country. So if we look at that, we are not a third world nation.
Martin?
And anyhow, I'm going to criticise you about the use of the third world nation and that man. When I was teaching geography, we talked about developing countries.
Yes.
Because you build on what the people are doing there and you give them encouragement. You don't put them down. And that third world nation, and I hope all journalists in this country are listening, should be talking about developing countries and not third world.
Well, the term third world, of course, originally developed because you had the first world, which was the capitalist world in the West, the second world, which was the communist world, and the third world, which was the rest. And of course, it doesn't really describe our reality of today, does
it's
it?
It's quite difficult knowing which term to use sometimes because you also get told off, oh, you should call it the South, you know, the global South.
Yeah, but the global South, apart from the bits that are in the North, yes.
Yes.
I go back, geography, this developing country... was 25 years ago when I was teaching geography to youngsters. So, you know, it's not a new phrase. So what's wrong with people who still use third world? You're putting people down and that's not right.
What about the Pope's visit generally, though? Are you happy to see a state visit from the Pope, Brenda?
Oh, I think as the head of one of the great faiths of the world, we have to recognise that he does go around and make state visits to people. I think he's got a difficult task on his hands and should show serious regret about what was going on with child abuse, because I don't think anyone should be above the law, whoever they are, and those priests have broken the law. And having said that, well, our own bishop in this city is very forward-looking, Bishop Declan, and I have respect for that man. And this sort of scandal that's going around doesn't do any of the decent priests and bishops we have any good at all.
Martin, what are your thoughts about having the Pope here? Because, of course, it is actually his first ever visit, a state visit, which has actually been paid for partly by the taxpayer.
Yes, and of course, at the moment, we're talking about trying to save money, so it's come at a rather awkward moment for him to come. Nevertheless, I agree with Brenda that things like this are bound to happen. I mean, but Pope John Paul II came to visit Britain. I don't think it was a state visit, but his role, he went to Ireland in that visit, and his visit there was very instrumental in helping to kickstart the whole process that led to the Good Friday Agreement years later. So I think the Catholic Church, and I used to work for a Catholic organisation, I used to work for the Catholic Fund for Overseas Development, can be a fantastic force for good in the world. And also, of course, when they get it wrong, they can be a fantastic force for evil. Yeah. So it's a tremendous, you know, that's the problem with religion.
Did you
it?
Just say the Catholic Church was a fantastic force for evil?
It can be a fantastic force for good or a fantastic force for evil. I mean, for example, Pope Benedict was talking about Britain being a force for good in the world because of the standing up to Nazi Germany. It's rather strange coming from him, because we got pictures of him in his SS uniform as a teenager.
No, I think he was in the Hitler Youth, actually. And of course, it's ever so difficult to blame somebody.
Well, of course, it's a long time ago. But at the same time, of course, you've got to remember that the Vatican did help ex-Nazis to escape from justice at the end of the war. And the Catholic Church in Spain and in Croatia was very pro-fascist. So the Catholic Church doesn't have a kind of unblemished record on anti-fascism. But absolutely not.
Having said that, a lot of sort of oppression that's been going on in South America, the Catholic Church has been in the only network.
Indeed,
Helping people.
Archbishop Romero, a great man. And of course, what you find is, like most other things, you've got some fantastically good people and some fantastically bad and some fantastically silly people all in the same organisation. But there you go.
So do you think this is going to be overall a positive visit, Brenda?
Well, I hope so. I mean, we need a lot of positive visits from lots of people, a force for good in this country at the moment.
And whilst talking about the Catholic faith, the Oasis School in Westbury is opening its doors to students for the first time this week. Formerly known as St Ursula's School, which was a Catholic school, it went into administration at the end of last term. The former Catholic organisation in Westbury on Trim was bought by Bristol City Council. Now, you were mentioning, I think, this earlier on. Some money has been spent by the council on buying the land, you said. Can you tell us any more about what's happening with this new school, which has been taken over by the council?
Well, as I said earlier, £2 million cabinet on the 20th of August agreed to buy the land. And then they came up with an agreement with the Oasis School. And what worries me considerably are many things, but this one particularly. There will be no rental charge by the council for the use of premises. Now, hang on, if we're in a state and we need money, why not, is my question. When we come up to Oasis and any of these academies that are run by any faith organisations, then I have serious reservations and I'm very fearful of what's going to happen.
Well, it's going for academy status, apparently. Bosses at Oasis Community Learning tell us, this is Jack FM they were telling, that they already are having talks with the Department for Education about the school becoming an academy. They say it could happen by September 2011. Until then, Oasis School Westbury will continue as a fee-paying school. Should the City Council be buying schools which are actually now fee-paying schools, or should they only be buying schools which are part of the state sector?
They shouldn't be buying schools, but as far as I'm aware, they have bought the land, which therefore could be seen as
indirect subsidy.
Indirect subsidy or a good investment, but I'm this academy business, this is why I'm cross about this. No rental charge, because the money will come from government for the academies, so therefore the council should benefit from that money, and this is a difficult one. Now, the other thing I'm worried about are exempt papers, which I have not been able to see. I'm only a councillor elected by the people, but never mind. There is a system, and I'm supposed to go down there and see what these exempt papers are saying, because they'll all be about the financial needs. In a way...
You're talking about exempt papers. That is to say that there are certain aspects of this which, as a councillor, you're not allowed to see
unless
the financial case that's been made.
And I have to sign a form that I'm seeing them, that I won't divulge anything. Now, I know about exempt business because of my role as chair of PSP. But what frightens me about this is £2 million. Hang on. Will it only be £2 million? I don't think so. There'll be a lot more money spent on this, I suspect. And I'm worried that to the detriment of Mill Pond School here, because the work hasn't started yet, and they've had £12 million of the first tranche of government money for Mill Pond. Why hasn't the work started there and in Whitehall? And even the councillor in Whitehall is very worried about that, and he's a Lib Dem, and they're running the city.
Martin, what are your thoughts on what's happened to St Ursula's? At least it's been saved, surely, you know, even if it has had a bit of council money spent on it.
Yes, but I mean, don't forget, it was a private school. From reading of the article here, St Ursula's was a private school, and so is Oasis School of Westbury. Frankly, if they're going to be private, they should be private, and we shouldn't have to be arguing about what support they should be getting from us. An issue that shocks me is that Colston Girls' School is going to be an academy and absorbed into the Bristol City Council's spending, remit. I mean, I've got nothing against Colston Girls' School. I'm sure it's a perfectly good school, but really, can we have just free-for-alls where people set up their own schools, then demand funding from the local authority, and existing schools are not having their buildings renewed and looked after? We should be looking after our own schools first, and then and only then thinking about what should be happening with private enterprise.
Well, he's quite right, and I'm still trying to find out what's happening to Mill Pond, and I hope the parents are listening to me, because maybe we should go and ask people and get a petition or something organised, say it's time it started. They've had this money for 18 months, the 12 million.
Well, the whole cutting of the school building refurbishment programme by the coalition, I mean, that just says what their priorities are, doesn't it? We're going to cut the refurbishment programme that the Labour government had set up, and then we're going to ring-fence loads of money for all sorts of new schools, which are going to be sort of elitist academies set up in posh areas, and loads of money's been put aside for them, whereas existing schools are not going to get their investments.
Well, this is an academy, and you couldn't consider Lawrence Hill a posh area, Martin.
Well, I know, but the academy programme is run by I don't actually approve of academies even so, but the academy programme is run by the Labour government was that academies had to be in deprived areas. Academies can now be anywhere, which is basically, let's open the door to having a whole new raft of middle-class schools funded by the government, which will exclude those that we want to exclude, the children that actually probably need more spent on them rather than less.
Mm. Tony, I've got to give you this quotation for everyone listening. Work has already commenced on the prioritisation of existing schemes within the Children's and Young People's Services Capital Programme to release funding. What is happening to Mill Pond? There's no openness about this. Why isn't Claire Campion-Smith championing this?
Well, maybe you could send her one of those little wonderful little Freedom of Information requests and find out, Brenda. Yeah. Anyway, next story, accept cuts or fail your children. That's the bank governor who's ignoring the union walkout at the TUC conference to deliver a double dip recession warning to the trades unions of Britain. Well, this is Mervyn King at the TUC conference in London. It's up to you to come up with an alternative, said Mervyn to the trade unionists. And
it wasn't in London, it was in Manchester.
Sorry, in Manchester, yes, you're absolutely right. So Mervyn King is saying it's up to you to come up with an alternative. This is actually quite sensible of Mervyn King, the governor of the Bank of England, Martin, isn't it, to say, look, if you think you can do it better, then tell us how to do it better, because they're doing their best, aren't they?
What's happened over the previous electoral cycle is that what we should have been talking about is how to reboot the tax system to get the money off the wealthy classes. And we used to, in the 1950s, people would have been absolutely okay about using these kind of terms.
But the
top
thing
rate
is, Martin,
of tax in the 1950s under a Conservative government was 96%. Now, if we want to solve the problems we now face without inflation, We could have inflation, of course. That's another option that people are not thinking of. But let's say we don't want inflation and we're not just going to print money, then we've got to reduce the deficit. The logical place to reduce that deficit is by taking some of the wealth off the top 1% in Britain, who control 50% of the wealth.
But you can't necessarily do that. Just let me point this out, Martin, because a lot of them, like Stephen Lansdowne, decide if it looks like they're going to be massively taxed, they just move to the Channel Islands.
No, but they've got lots of property in this country. But this is why you have to have property taxes, because property can't move. Most of what's happened in the last generation in this country has been speculation around real estate. That is, to say, around buildings. Buildings can't be taken off to the Channel Island. Also, I'd also say this, that if people want to leave the country to avoid paying British tax, that's absolutely fine. But we will take away their passports and they won't get them back. And if their children want to go to private schools in this country, they won't be able to because they won't have right of residence. We've got to get tough with the wealthy classes who've crashed the economy. Never mind getting tough with teachers and post office workers. It's either us or them. And if it's us or them, it's got to be them. And in the 1950s, people knew that they had to pay. People, the boys were fighting on the Imjin River against the Chinese communists, and the top race of tax was 96%. And everybody knew where they stood in society, and everybody knew what they had to pay and what they were offering. Some people were paying with blood, other people were paying with money. And the attitude that we can't tax the rich because we can't, because otherwise they'll throw a fit and go off somewhere else, that's just no good at all. That attitude's got to change.
Now, Brenda, what about Bob Crowe from the RMT union just walking out of the conference and he went to watch a children's television apparently as Mervyn King was speaking? Isn't that a bit cheeky?
I suppose he's sickened with Mervyn King saying that.
But he should at least surely be sitting there listening and then contributing to the discussions.
I suppose he can pick up later. I'm sickened that Mervyn King says all this, and yet the banks that we, the taxpayers, have bailed out are making huge profits. And yet the ordinary people, my people in this ward, some of whom only live on £100 a week, are going to have to deal with the cuts to prop up these rich businessmen. And is that fair? What about this fair society? There isn't such a thing in these cabinet members who are going along with this. 17 out of 23 as millionaires, they don't understand the meaning of the word.
Well, ahead of the address to the Trade Union Congress in Manchester, Mr. Crowe had declared the governor unwelcome. This is Mervyn King, the governor of the Bank of England, claiming his appearance was like Christians asking the devil to address them. He said, "This is our Congress, and I don't think he should have been invited. He's on the side of the bosses. He's not welcome here." Now, this is not really conducive to sensible and adult debate, Martin, is it?
Listen, that's Bob Crowe's point of view, and that's as adult as it gets. And other people thought it was a good idea to invite Mervyn King, and they can justify that if they like. The fact is, I'm perfectly happy to have a debate with whoever, but there's no reason why we should kowtow to their ideas. Mervyn King, and indirectly, as a protector of the interests of the City of London, is one of those responsible for the mess. Absolutely. And if he wants to stand in front of the TUC and try and tell them that they are responsible, the answer to that, it should be, well, no, we're not responsible, you're responsible. And we've got to start getting a more robust discussion about this. In the 1950s, as I said earlier, there was no problem about saying, I mean, Dennis Healey in the 1970s said, we're going to tax the rich until the pips squeak. That's what he said to a Labour Party conference, to cheers. Now, we've lost all of that because we got into the Mandelson era of we're relaxed about people being filthy rich. The problem with people being filthy rich is somebody else has to be rotten poor, and we can't put up with that. We've got to get back to a robust discussion about this.
Now, as Brenda said earlier on, there are people, many people living on tiny amounts of money a week.
£100 is actually quite good. I mean, I'm on an employment benefit at the moment. It's £63 a week.
And we hear in the Daily Mail on Monday this week, fresh bonus boom for boardroom pay as the gravy train steams ahead. The boardroom gravy train has cranked back into life with pay packages for top executives returning to boom era levels. That is, as if there was no recession, research has revealed. Despite the longest recession on record, bonuses for the FTSE 100 directors shot back to normal levels last year, according to a report by auditors Deloitte. Directors say that the UK's top 30 companies banked an average bonus of 140% of their base salary. That is 20% higher than the year before. The Bonanza came after many firms lowered performance hurdles, believing 2009 would be extremely difficult. When the economy bounced back more strongly than expected, bosses exceeded their targets with ease, triggering meaty payouts for the top brass. Earnings are going up for less senior staff too, with the average base salary for a junior city worker leaping 12% from 63,000, well, actually nearly 63,000 to 70,500 in the past year, says recruitment firm Asprey Marsden. So what are your thoughts, Brenda, about this? Because it seems like we've got the divide in society is getting wider and wider. Ooh, now, this actually happened a lot under your Labour government, didn't it?
Yes, well, I think when Mandelson and Blair said they don't mind people getting very rich, they'd lost sight of the fact they were governing the whole country. And there are a lot of people in my ward who live on very little. And today, when I was over in Barton Hill, £5 a week is a lot of money to some people. To these people, they can just throw it away. And, you know, it really grieves me.
Martin, what about this? Because this is bucking the recession, isn't it?
Can I
the bankers are a little bit ahead of the recession.
Can I just make a point about this? When the taxpayer stepped in to bail out the banks 2 years ago, what we did was basically help them to pay the interest on their dead loans. Yeah. So in other words, the banks are still insolvent. These profits are phantom profits. They don't really exist. Because the government is underwriting the losses of the banks, they can say, yes, on paper we're showing a profit. But it's only a paper profit. In actual fact, the banks are still insolvent. They probably need to be completely nationalised, bankrupted in an orderly fashion, and most of these people sacked and put to do some useful work. The idea that somehow that we're out of the recession is simply wrong, and that the banks are solvent is simply wrong. But this is a confidence trick against the rest of society.
But it does seem, doesn't it, that actually these bankers are able to pay themselves this amount of money. Surely it does look like the recession could be over.
The recession is not over. The retail sales have started to go down. Most serious economists recognise that we're not out of the woods.
But George Osborne could call you a deficit denier, wouldn't he?
No, I'm not a deficit denier. We've got to reduce the deficit by increasing taxes on George Osborne and his chums. We're absolutely clear about this. People like George Osborne and his chums must pay a lot more taxes. And we're not just talking about income taxes, we're talking about wealth taxes. If there's a big hole in the budget, we'll calculate what we need to spend. We need to increase government expenditure, by the way, of course, not just keep it at the same level. We should be absolutely talking to the people in these terms. We need a new deal like we needed in the 30s. And I hope whoever wins our leadership election has got what it takes to go out to the people and push this kind of idea. Because we can't just say we're going to do it like the Tories, but a bit better. We've got to stand up for what we believe in, which is public investment, whatever the cost. And if that means raising taxes on wealthy people, well, so be it. And I want to hear a new Labour leader coming out with what we used to call Labour values.
Why do you have to raise taxes? Why can't you just print money? Because Mervyn King's doing that again.
You could do a bit of printing money as well, but that brings in inflation. Inflation actually wouldn't be a bad thing as long as everything's index linked.
Come on now, but inflation just means your savings get eroded, all the prices in the shops go up.
Well, actually, inflation means that you can buy your house for £6,000 and sell it for £300,000 20 years later. And in actual fact, that's how most people...
That's okay if you've got a house, isn't it?
Yes, indeed.
Most people have.
I'm not saying that we should go for inflation. I'm just saying that the idea that we shouldn't have inflation is another one of the options that we're not looking at. We could have a bit of inflation because inflation actually is bad for the wealthy. It undermines their pile. That's one of the ways to get money off them other than raising taxes.
Well, we're coming up to the Sky News at 6 now, thanks to this week's guest, Chair of Bristol City Public Safety and Protection Committee and Labour Councillor for Lawrence Hill, Brenda Hoggill. After the news, we look at nuclear stuff going down in Hinckley and electronic elections. Are they safe?
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.